This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, fish are dying, swathes of riverbeds and channels are parched. One of the nation's most vital water systems is under threat. We discuss what's going wrong with the Murray-Darling Basin.
We've seen rapid development of all of those Darling River tributaries, the Macquarie, the Namoi, the Gwydir, the Border Rivers, Condamine, Ballon, and a little bit of the Warrego. And that means there's a lot less water in this river than there used to be.
I think it's a compound of issues and we need to look up as much as down.
Also today, residents say they're too scared to go back to their apartments in Sydney's faulty Opal Tower, despite being assured they can return. And Donald Trump says he's not worried at all, as his former lawyer and confidant Michael Cohen agrees to give testimony in public to the American Congress. Welcome to PM. The nation has been outraged by the sickening sight of up to a million fish dead near Menindi in the southwest of New South Wales, an area that's part of the Murray-Darling Basin, the largest and most complex river system in Australia. But it's not the only fish kill this summer, with hundreds of fish dying in rivers and lakes around New South Wales in particular. The immediate reasons for each kill are different, and experts say we shouldn't be surprised if there are more of these this summer. But the crisis has engendered another round of the blame game and denials all around that the iconic and vital river system is being mismanaged. We'll speak with two people steeped in this issue in just a moment to tease out the questions and look forward to a solution. But first, Nancy Notson has this report.
Oh, yellow belly's dead.
Yellow belly over there.
Lot of yellow belly dead, lot of carp.
It's a gruesome look at the environmental impact of a damaged ecosystem. Andrew King shot this video of the Namoi River near Gunnedah in northern New South Wales just a few weeks ago.
A lot of more dead fish. Everywhere dead fish.
The water dropped so quickly and the temperature rose so quickly. Basically, they were cooked in the water. It was just horrendous to see.
That's Anne Michie, the head of the Lake Keepit Family Fishing Club. The fish kill shown in the video happened in the river just below Keepit Dam, which has now basically run dry.
Keepit Dam has had a huge water release, block release, happen in December last year. It's been drained down to a historically low level. No one's ever seen it at this lower level before. Ever, and then they've shut off all the water running out of the dam, which in effect has then ceased the flow of the Namoi River downstream of the dam.
Anne Michie believes the water resource needs to be better managed and has started a petition she hopes would see its minimum capacity never go lower than 20%.
We're trying to get that instated across all water storages in New South Wales at a minimum of 20%. So we're holding up Keepit as the poster child of dam abuse. This is exactly how you don't do it.
But New South Wales Water, which manages the dam, says the drought means there's been basically no inflows to the dam in the past 18 months. And it's implemented increasingly stringent conditions on water usage as the drought's intensified. It wants to ensure nearby regional communities and landholders get crucial water supplies. And the New South Wales Department of Primary Industry says drought has caused many other fish kills across the state, including at the Lachlan River at Wyangala Dam. And just in the last few days, hundreds of fish were found dead at Lake Cattai near Port Macquarie on the state's mid-north coast. Dr. Margaret Platell from the University of Newcastle says there could be more on the way.
I wouldn't be surprised, given that we are in a bit of a drought condition at the moment as well. So we've also got shallower water bodies, less water around, which will heat up more quickly as well. It really depends on the amount of rainfall that's coming in the systems and the coolness of the air temperature.
While lack of oxygen in water is the main cause of fish kills, that can happen for different reasons, like when water released from a dam is low in oxygen.
That can also occur from when you get inundation of surrounding the land surrounding a river, and the decomposition of organic material from that inundation will also suck up the oxygen as well. What you can also find, which I think, you know, which is what seems to be happening in Menindee, you have quite a large algal bloom, and that has died and started decomposing and taking up the oxygen from the water.
The fish kill at Menindee is what, of course, has sparked so much debate this week, after over a million fish were found dead in the Darling River. Some blame over-allocation for irrigation and mismanagement of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. The federal government blames the drought. But whatever the cause, the basics in any aquatic environment remain the same.
The less water there is, the less habitat there is for fish. The shallower the water, the more likely it is to heat up, the more possible it may be that a perfect storm of events will come together.
And so Dr. Platel says it's time authorities review what's going on, their current strategies, and the lasting impacts the disasters might have.
Any review needs to be including that kind of rigorous evidence as well, but also too the social attitudes of the people that are affected by this water management. And there, you know, is of course a range of stakeholders as well, and their perception of the problem is going to be part of the evidence used to build a case for possibly changing management as well.
Dr. Margaret Platel is from the University of Newcastle. Nancy Notson, our reporter. So what is wrong with the Murray-Darling Basin that despite decades of political blood and sweat to solve irrigation and environmental tensions, there's been another mass fish kill? Well, I was joined earlier by Karen Martin. She's the chair of South Australian Murray Irrigators and by one of the nation's top experts on river management, Professor Richard Kingsford, who's director of the Centre for Ecosystem Science at the University of New South Wales. Thank you both for joining PM today. Drought or too much water being taken out of the system or just the decision to drain the Menindee Lakes, what is the problem that led to this terrible situation with the fish kill? Karen Martin, you're an irrigator in South Australia. What's your perspective?
Well, we're still waiting to hear more information about it. It's certainly concerning. I don't hold with the rhetoric that it's because Menindee Lakes has been drained that has caused this. I think it's a compound of issues and we need to look up as much as down.
You mean up the river as much as down the river?
Yeah, certainly. And why it came to that? Why was the quality as such and why couldn't that have been managed to avoid it?
And Richard Kingsford, you were part of a group of experts who last year signed the Murray-Darling Basin Declaration to explain to the public what was going wrong with the way the basin was being managed. But before we get to the plan itself, what is your view about this particular fish kill and what it indicates?
Oh, look, I agree with Karen. This is, and that's certainly what the experts from the Department of Primary Industries are saying about the local issues. It's a combination of what's happening in that 30 or 40 kilometres of the river near Menindee Lakes, but it's also how the Menindee Lakes have been managed. And the historical content is that this problem has been coming for 20 or 30 years because we've seen rapid development of all of those Darling River tributaries, the Macquarie, the Namoi, the Gwydir, the Border Rivers, Condamine, Boulon, and a little bit of the Warrego over the last 20 or 30 years. And that means there's a lot less water in this river than there used to be.
Karen, as an irrigator in South Australia, watching that development that Richard has just described over the last 20 years, is this something that you would have forecast might be coming our way?
The developments that Richard was alluding to have been going on for decades, and that's the type of information that was provided to the authority during the basin planning process. And that is possibly the root cause of the problems. And I suppose, given the historic context of agreements, we would have hoped that those agreements would have been adhered to and stuck to and be using that environmental water to affect environmental health, not the opposite.
Just sticking with you on that, Karen, what do you mean? I mean, as you say, there's been all of this hard work and agreements, but you say some people are not sticking to the agreements. Who in particular?
South Australia capped its use in 1967. And in 1997, there were CAP agreements, and in 2004, there were national water initiatives, and in 2012, there was a basin plan. And South Australia, its irrigators and all its water users have abided by those commitments. And we feel that every time there's been a new policy initiative, that it's most particularly been New South Wales and Queensland, that argue their way out of actually doing what they agreed to do. And I feel like we're in that situation again where it's taken a fish kill for those arguments to come to the surface. And again, they're not looking at the root cause of the problem or admitting any fault or culpability in this.
Richard Kingsford, given what Karen has just described, would you say the Murray-Darling Basin plan is doing the job it set out to do? It was set up as a bit of a saviour in a situation of deep division, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. And look, I think it's trying. And I think there are lots of elements of the basin plan that are difficult and they are progressing. I think the issue that Karen's raised is absolutely true. There have been shifting interpretations, shifting benchmarks. There was a Murray-Darling Basin cap of 1997. It was supposed to be at 93, 94 levels of development. And yet, you know, we find out that floodplain harvesting now in New South Wales wasn't subject to that. Everybody thought at the time it was subject to that. New South Wales government is reinterpreting that to a 2008 baseline. So we've got this grandfathering going on of these policies that are sort of made many years afterwards, all of which are capturing more and more of that water with the long-term impacts on the whole river system.
Just talk a little bit more about that, if you would, just in terms of the water we're talking about. This isn't just about irrigators putting pipes in rivers and sucking it out, is it? There are other ways that people collect water that belongs to the basin.
Look, absolutely. I mean, we need to understand that, that governments and society has essentially sanctioned these developments over the last 30 years. Various governments of all persuasions have been on this path. We've built dams in the Great Dividing Range that capture a lot of the tributary water in the Darling. That the Darling is much more variable than the River Murray, and so there are also lots of floods coming in and tributaries coming in downstream of those dams, and these were all called uncontrolled floods. What we've seen over the last 30 years is, I would call, runaway development on the floodplains of the Darling River Basin, mainly to grow cotton, and whereby irrigators are able to capture the flows that aren't caught in those big dams by pumping water into large storages. And that's variously called flood harvesting. And also, because some of these places are on the floodplains, there are ways of capturing water that comes across it, which means that we don't really have a very good idea about how much water is being diverted in those areas. And, you know, some audits have shown that, you know, perhaps up to 50% of water isn't actually metered in New South Wales. So there's these long-term tricky policy shifting benchmarks, a whole range of issues that at the implementation level are undermining, you know, the great investment and, I guess, you know, that goal setting that's the basis of the basin plan.
Karen Martin, what do you think is the answer? I mean, you know, in the midst of this crisis in particular, there is already a South Australian Royal Commission. New South Wales is saying it might have an inquiry too. Is another inquiry what's needed?
I personally, and on behalf of our members, would call for the Federal Royal Commission. I think anything short of that now is rehashing old ground. We've done a lot of Senate inquiries. We've done a lot of state-level inquiries. The Four Corners report prompted New South Wales to do a lot of compliance inquiries that they'd never even done before, which shocked everybody that late in the piece. But it prompted them to do it, and they are doing that now. So more inquiries will give you more of the same. It's now taking that information, going back over it, looking at what the recommendations were and were they implemented, and if they weren't, why not, and should we maybe implement a few of the recommendations.
Richard Kingsford, is the problem here that there is not an enforcer on the block?
Well, look, that's partly it, and, you know, there's a lot of politics involved here, so And that was why the Murray-Darling Basin Commission didn't work very well, because essentially all the states got together and then discussed what needed to be done. And if one state said no, then it wasn't done. So we don't have that. The Water Act under the Murray-Darling Basin Authority allows for some oversight, but it doesn't have any real punitive ability to reprimand or punish states that aren't behaving well. The other part of it is that there's a very strong ability to push industry's viewpoint on what should be done, and that varies up and down the river. Generally, we hear more from the irrigation industry on water than we do, say, from traditional owners or people living up and down the river. So there's a whole voiceless community out there, which I think, particularly with this fish kill, have really sent a message.
Richard Kingsford, thank you very much. And Karen Martin, thank you very much indeed as well.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Karen Martin is the chair of South Australian Murray Irrigators, and river management expert Professor Richard Kingsford is the director of the Centre for Ecosystem Science at the University of New South Wales. You're listening to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. On Twitter, I'm at Linda Mottram if you want to get in touch that way. Stay listening, though. We'll take a look at apartments and their issues in two cities, as residents are told it is safe to return to Sydney's troubled Opal Tower, but many are sceptical. They're staying out until they're given further assurances, while everyone awaits a key report that's been ordered by the state government. That's ahead. It's been an unedifying week for many Americans watching their leaders this week as Donald Trump has dug in on his wall and Democrats have dug in on their refusal to fund it. So the government shutdown limps on, leaving hundreds of thousands of public servants without pay. But that's not the only issue facing the president. Multiple strands of the Mueller investigation into Russian election interference and other issues began coming together late in 2018. And now, one of those who's apparently been particularly useful to the special counsel, Donald Trump's former personal lawyer Michael Cohen, has agreed to give evidence in public to Congress next month. Angela Lavoie-Pierre reports.
The Democrats have only just gained control of the House, but they're already on their way to ticking a big item off the party's bucket list, a public grilling of Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's former lawyer.
We are in search of the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. So that's where we stand.
Democrat Elijah Cummings is the chairman of the House Oversight Panel. And the whole truth might be a bit of a stretch. He's also promised not to jeopardise the ongoing investigation into alleged collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia.
We're going to make sure that we do absolutely nothing to interfere with the Mueller investigation. That is very, very important to us.
It's not immediately clear what will be involved in the hearing.
But as far as this hearing is concerned, we put out our statement. It's a very limited statement. We plan to do what the American people have asked us to do, that is to conduct hearings with integrity, with transparency, with honesty, and most importantly, accountability.
Michael Cohen is due to begin a 3-year prison sentence in March. During his trial, he implicated his former boss, Donald Trump, in a scheme to pay illegal hush money to two women, with whom the president is alleged to have had extramarital affairs. Donald Trump denies the alleged affairs and claims the payoffs didn't violate campaign finance laws. He's shrugged off the news of Cohen's testimony, which is due on the 7th of February.
And I'm not worried about it at all, no.
In a statement, Michael Cohen said he looks forward to giving a full and credible account of the events which have transpired. These developments, which might have dominated headlines, have been dwarfed by the rolling crisis that is the government shutdown, brought on by an impasse over funding for Donald Trump's long-promised US-Mexico border wall. Overnight, the president gave the strongest sign yet. He's still willing to take the extraordinary step of declaring a national emergency, effectively bypassing the need for approval from Congress.
I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. The lawyers have so advised me. I'm not prepared to do that yet, but if I have to, I will. I have no doubt about it. I will. I have the absolute right to declare this was passed by Congress. So when you say, was it passed by Congress? It was. Other presidents have used it, some fairly often. I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. I haven't done it yet. I may do it. If this doesn't work out, probably I will do it. I would almost say definitely.
Donald Trump could still take that option, but it's not clear how durable it would be. Dr. Charles Edel is a senior fellow at the US Studies Centre at the University of Sydney.
There would be immediate legal challenges, but they would come on multiple fronts. There are both statutory challenges, because the way that the National Emergency Act of 1976 works is that once the president declares a national emergency, the House of Representatives then gets to affirm whether or not that's true and whether or not their powers then get delegated to the executive branch. There will also be legal challenges on this front, possibly from Congress, possibly from outside of Congress. And there will also be immediate legal challenges if they move forward with any type of construction projects by multiple landowners who presumably will have their land appropriated through eminent domain down in Texas and other parts of the border.
If Donald Trump does decide to press ahead with an emergency declaration, it would certainly be unprecedented, no matter how long it stands.
It has never happened that a president has declared a state of emergency to get funds appropriated to carry out a policy goal that he was not able to get Congress to appropriate in the first place. That is unprecedented.
Dr. Charles Edel from the University of Sydney, Angela Lavoie-Pierre reporting. Some residents of a faulty Sydney tower block say they want better safety assurances before they move back into their apartments. They're residents of the Opal Tower. It's in Sydney's Olympic Park. And while many of us were busy getting festive on Christmas Eve, the residents there were being evacuated from the building after cracks appeared in it. The tower was completed late last year, and the construction company has been scrambling to get answers amid warnings that many other apartment blocks hastily erected during Sydney's housing boom could have similar problems. I spoke a short time ago to our Western Sydney reporter, Jonathan Hare.
Linda, so the update today is that some of them have been told that they'll be able to go back in from this weekend, except if you live in 50 of the apartments that have been most damaged in this incident. So the people that are in those apartments have been told that they have between 1 and 6 weeks still to wait while the damage that was found there on Christmas Eve is fixed back up. And of course, that is incredibly frustrating for some of the residents who have told us they just want to go home, but also that they just want to know that their apartments are now safe. They're waiting for a report that the state government commissioned that is meant to tell them what caused this damage and whether the damage has now been fixed, but that is yet to be made public. We know that the Minister for Planning, Anthony Roberts, got that report today from those two independent engineers that have been working on it, but it's yet to be released to the public. People are being told that there's still a number of days before that will happen. Of course, we talked to the New South Wales Opposition's Tanya Mihailuk.
We're in the dark as well. The public are in the dark, the residents are in the dark. It's not clear precisely where the government's up to. We know apparently the investigation is going to be complete today into the structural defects, that yet there's no report being released in that regard. We're asking the government to release the terms of agreement in relation to this particular sale. We now know they pocketed $48 million. But what we need to know is what were the terms of agreement that was reached? Why is the government so secretive?
Tanya Mihailuk from the Labor opposition in New South Wales. Jonathan Hare, her point there goes to the question, doesn't it, of who's going to be liable for any restoration?
Yeah, that's right. And at the moment, it's kind of up in the air as to who is actually liable for this. Of course, the developer is blaming the construction company. The construction company is blaming some of its subcontractors. As of yet, no one's actually said, yes, this was our fault. And that's what some people are hoping will be contained in this independent report that's been commissioned by the state government. Some are hoping that it will attribute some blame. But there's also been some reports around today around the way the Act in New South Wales is written. The developer could be classed as the person that actually owns the land. And of course, this development is at Sydney Olympic Park. The land is owned by the Sydney Olympic Park Authority, which is an entity of the New South Wales government. So there's a lot of questions still up in the air about who is actually liable for the damage in this building.
Now, you mentioned residents earlier. Are any of them happy to move back in?
Many of the ones we've spoken to say they really want to see the independent report before they go back in. They say that obviously after the shock of Christmas Eve and then being allowed back in the days that followed only to be evacuated once again and put in hotels, they're saying that they're really unsure about this. Many of the ones we've spoken to are tenants, not owners, and so some are trying to get out of their lease or something like that at the moment. But at this stage, many just want to see some independent advice as to what is actually wrong with their apartment.
And of course, this tower is one of scores that rapidly leapt into the Sydney skyline during the recent apartment building boom. Naturally, it begs the question, are there others? Do we know?
Yeah, that's right. So this is a really hard thing to get a gauge on in Sydney at the moment. So a lot of experts that have been popping up since this ordeal started have said that, yes, this is the tip of the iceberg, but it's really hard to nail down exactly where this might be happening elsewhere. And one of the problems around this is it's been described to me as a culture of silence where people don't want to come forward with their stories of defects because they know it might drastically reduce the property price of the thing they've bought or the place they live if they come forward with these kinds of stories. And so people often just cop it on the chin instead of going public with the defects that they've found in their homes, in their apartments. So at this stage, it's really hard to get a gauge on, but some are calling for more certainty and for more information about where these defects can be found.
Jonathan Hare is our Western Sydney reporter. The issues with Sydney's Opal Tower have sparked chatter, not just about other apartment buildings in Sydney, but also in the building industry in Queensland. That state's building regulator says it hasn't seen anything as bad as the situation at Opal Tower. But industry consultants say that there are compliance issues with high-rise buildings in Queensland. And there are concerns about questions like a lack of insurance and the intentional stacking of bodies corporate, which are leaving unit owners liable for defects. Isabel Rowe reports.
Over the past few years, Brisbane has been riding the crest of a wave of apartment construction. There are now over 10,000 more units in Brisbane compared with 6 years ago. While the boom has been good for business, it's brought with it problems, especially when it comes to the quality of some projects. Gary Carpenter is a building consultant.
I've been involved with doing inspection work over the last 20 years, and I'm fully employed. So it's a case of building to building, from one day to the next. Yeah, there are issues with high-rise buildings, waterproofing on any day of the year.
Mr. Carpenter gets involved when apartment owners notice some defective building work and they want an independent assessment. He says the rush to get properties on the market has seen some builders cut corners.
If there's an issue with a building and people involved have a vested interest in, if they're working for a profit-making organisation, they'd have a vested interest in saving as much money as they can. There's often a case in my experience where the options taken by people with that vested interest to rectify an issue may take a more cost-effective measure rather than a measure that might be a better measure.
Defects can be referred to the regulator, the Queensland Building and Construction Commission, or the QBCC. But Mr. Carpenter says the issue with high-rise towers is that they're uninsured.
The QBCC can issue a direction on a builder, or they have the discretion to issue a direction on a builder to rectify defective work. The issue is that if a building is higher than three stories over a car park, then there's no insurance and there's no warranty on available to the owners of the building.
The ABC has spoken to others involved in the industry, including unit owners, who won't speak publicly for fear of devaluing their apartments. But the peak body representing builders says most projects are completed to a high standard. Paul Bidwell is from Master Builders Queensland.
We've got a very robust licensing system for builders and all trade contractors. We've got a strong private certification model where they're all licensed and they've got to do continuing professional development. We've got minimum financial requirements for all licensed contractors. We've got non-conforming building product legislation. So if the product that was used was dodgy, then the QBCC and ultimately the Minister for Housing and Public Works can take action.
But he does admit protections are geared towards standalone houses.
If the builder doesn't do as they are directed by the QBCC to fix the problem, the QBCC can then go and fix it under the home warranty insurance. And then the QBCC chase the builder. So the consumer is off the hook. But that doesn't apply in high-rise.
Why would you want to buy a high-rise apartment in that case?
Well, it's not for me. It's a very good question, because what is the difference between someone like renovating a home, which whether it's a in a duplex, let's say, versus renovating something on the 34th floor of one of those towers in the CBD? It's an interesting question. I think governments over the years have looked at it and have never done anything about it.
The president of the Strata Community Association Queensland, Simon Barnard, says he wants yearly building inspections mandated by law so bodies corporate find out about any structural issues early.
Isabel Rowe with that story. And that is PM for this week. PM's supervising producer is David Cody. Technical production by Mariam Zahr and Scott Johnston. Research by Flint Duxfield. Digital production, Mariella Attard. Web production by Maisie Cohen and Jacqueline Booth. You may already have the free ABC Listen app, but if not, get it on your smartphone because then you can listen to PM or to AM or The World Today when you're on the move or whenever you want to listen. Our stories are also at the website. Search ABC PM and you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we encourage you to share our stories to keep the conversations going. The PM team is back on Monday. Caroline Winter will be in the chair for the night on Monday, so I hope you'll join her and the rest of the team. Good night.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.